The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. In the heart of the international break, England slip up in the Czech Republic, prompting the biggest crisis in the country for minutes. Was it just a bad day at the office, or has this been coming, and what does this mean about football coming home? Wales draw twice but impress against the Croats, who didn't get tired but did get physical. Searching for positives in Scotland, they have a positive goal difference after their two games, the latter an incredibly soggy victory over San Marino. There's a board draw for the Republic and a gutting defeat for Northern Ireland. We'll round up all the qualifiers, the Football League, give you a Petr Cech Guildford update, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You left your croissants in the fridge.
I did. It's devastating. I had them prepared, put them in the fridge, had to come in early, and then was sort of halfway to the tube station and realised I'd forgotten them.
I mean, so it's the important
thing. It was raining, I was running late, so I didn't go back for them.
It's important for listeners to know that by the time they hear this, you will have been back in your house, so there's no point breaking into your house to steal the croissants.
Yes, that's correct.
Hey, Lars Siverton.
Hi, Max.
How are you?
I'm good.
I'm pleased you're good.
Mm-hmm.
Late draftee. You may have seen on social media that Nikki Bandini was due to come in, but her train turned around at Hayward's Heath. It's quite impressive for
on
a train.
On purpose, we should stress. It wasn't random.
No, it wasn't random. So we found Paul McInnes.
In a cupboard.
In a cupboard. Paul, how excited. Tyrone Mings like to be drafted in.
Highly.
Yeah.
Highly. Very excited. Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Max. You're a likeable guy.
That's very kind of you.
I've always seen Paul McInnes as much, very much the Tyrone Mings of the pod.
Just kicking people in the head occasionally and saying he didn't mean it. I mean, that's maybe harsh on Tyrone Mings, isn't it?
And Paul.
No, I think that's perfectly accurate description.
He's a very good player. Well, we'll get on to him because England lost on Friday night, 2-1 in the Czech Republic. First loss in a qualifier for 10 years. End of a 43-game unbeaten record in qualifiers. It was a bad performance. But everybody sort of, Barry, turned into, this was an existential England crisis, the worst thing that's ever happened. Where does your crisis level stand here?
Well, I couldn't care less, to be honest. But it was, it was a bad performance. Everyone's allowed, a bad day at the office. This was certainly one, possibly because they didn't play particularly well against Kosovo in the previous game. You could read more into it, but I wouldn't be overly concerned. I mean, as an outsider who isn't an England fan, I think a lot of England fans, yourself certainly included, think England are a lot better than they actually are. You know, they got to the semi-final of the World Cup, but had an easy route and got beaten by the first decent team they came up against. But they're going to qualify for the Euros with ease. Gareth Southgate is entitled to experiment, feel weak in sides, rest players, whatever, because ultimately that defeat isn't really going to matter. But I suppose a wake-up call, there's no harm in it.
What do you make of it, Paul?
I definitely agree with the fact that everybody's overreacted. And by everybody, I really mean the newspaper writers. I think the pundits on the telly were okay about it. But it's just the nature of things. For so long, like 50% of a newspaper football writer's job has been giving England a kick in, and we haven't been able to do that for a couple of years. So obviously, there's been pent up appetite. I do think one mysterious thing is the formation.
Mm-hmm.
Picking Mason Mount as a number 10, as he did. Mount, put himself about, was eager, but I don't think very effective. And there were lots of spaces when the ball was turned over going forward for the Czechs. And particularly of interest to me is because Southgate has said explicitly, we don't play with a number 10. I'm not picking, there's a reason he explicitly said for not picking Maddison. Now he's got another reason not to pick Maddison. But, he changed the shape to accommodate Mount. Obviously, people really like Mount, had a really good start to the season. I still think it's in development as to what he can actually bring to a team. Beyond, he's a technically accomplished player with a lot of energy and smarts. But I don't know why he chose to do that then. And it looks like he'll probably go back to a midfield three again. I think the midfield three that he played in Spain, which was an odd one, I think, but I think it was Henderson, Winks and Barkley. You now kind of put Rice into that although he's been a bit... Anyway, I think with a 4-3-3 is probably where we're at. We need a bit more solidity in the middle. And some of these players that he's bringing in are relatively inexperienced, and some of them, you know, Danny Rose, not in the best of form. So I think there's a couple of things that are not quite right with England, particularly if we do aspire to compete at the top level. But I do think it was an overreaction.
I do wonder if part of the angst is due to the fact that it looked like a return to the bad old days in some ways, right? I mean, England looked quite one-paced in possession, and they looked a bit porous at the back, and this is the kind of stuff that maybe a lot of people felt we'd left behind, or they'd left behind. It's interesting. I wonder if going to that sort of Rice and Henderson double pivot instead of a 4-3-3 was a reaction to how open they looked against Kosovo and wanting to firm it up a little bit.
We're 5-1 up at half time. I don't think it was tactical, the reason. We just thought it was done, thought it was too easy. And I think there was a bit of a problem with that against the Czechs as well. I thought we scored with the first attacking move we had. It was relatively easy. We opened them up, and then we thought, well, okay, here comes another 4-0 win.
Well, you have to score more goals than the one that to work,
but,
I guess.
You know what can go on in the head sometimes. It's like, you know, the complacency, it's a fine line between being arrogant, being complacent, between utterly switched on. I think there was a bit of that involved.
Yeah, well, I think then there is reason to be worried, because they did get a bit of a scare against Kosovo, in the sense that they conceded 3 goals. And certainly in the second half, there was a period when we saw that game on the train. There were the 2 goals that came against, and they weren't looking great towards the end of the game. And if you then go into an away game against a better opponent, and you're very, very complacent after going 1-0 up, then I think there is an issue in the squad, if what you're saying is correct.
They should have scored about 10 against Kosovo, though.
Quite a lot of the players in that team, particularly at the back, are not in good form at the moment. You know, Pickford's a bit ropey. Rose... isn't really getting a game for Spurs, and then Keane, Harry Maguire are both having pretty torrid times of it at club level. So
I think 3 of that back 4 might not play in that, if you were to pick a preferred 11. I think he does rate Keane. He obviously does. He's played him 6 times, him and Maguire together, 6 times on the trot, so he obviously sees something. And for me, I can't see what he's particularly good at. He seems to be an all-rounder, but not exceptional in anything. But I think, you know, you could imagine that he might he'd rather play Gomez if Gomez was playing first team football, and he'd rather play Chilwell and Trent Alexander at fullback.
Do you think he made a mistake by picking Trippier and Rhodes for this one? Because presumably he's saying, you'll play 90 minutes each, right? These are 2 games we should win. I'll keep the club manager sweet. You do 90 minutes each. Trippier is on form, probably not as good as Alexander-Arnold, but they're both good players. Yep. Rhodes is not on form, and Chilwell is. Obviously, hindsight is a wonderful thing, but the Czech Republic is a tougher game than Bulgaria. Why don't you play your best fullbacks?
Because you ask more of those players who might not be the first choice. You say, well, here's a real challenge for you. If you come out and you do well, then, you know, you've really drawn a line in the sand and said, you know, I'm up there and I'm fighting for this place. So you can see it both ways, and it all depends on whether it goes right or not. Mm. And, you know, if Harry Kane had scored that chance set up by Sterling when he goes with the outside of his right rather than just hitting it straight with his left, then it would have been 2-1. It would have been...
Narrative changes, exactly. Doesn't it?
I think not to obsess about this, but I mean, Henderson in midfield, like, his passing accuracy was at 67%. Like, he misplaced a third of his passes. And in central midfield at international level, you can't do that.
Is that because it's easier to play that role for Liverpool, or he's doing a different role slightly for England?
I think they were struggling to find each other. I mean, the last couple of games when he's been playing in a 3, the stats might say differently, but my experience of watching them live was that he barely gave the ball away. But I think that formation, they weren't comfortable with it, and a lot of emphasis was placed on Mount making the, you know, knitting it all together, and he didn't.
Tyrone Mings, he is on form. I mean, Villa aren't tearing up trees, but he has had a promising start to the season.
Yeah, I think it deserves his opportunity. I mean, there are other central defenders who are in form as well, who aren't even in the squad, who I think should be.
Connor Cody, is that?
Connor Cody, James Tarkowski, maybe. But, yeah, Mings, he is having a good season, while Aston Villa, as you say, aren't tearing up trees, and why not?
And Harry Winks, we think, will come in as well. And there's always a discussion about Harry Winks because he's slightly different style of football. He's not started the season brilliantly.
No, he hasn't. I just think because of the scarcity of other players with similar characteristics, he's become sort of weirdly pivotal to both Spurs and England, because you do lack that kind of midfielder who can receive the ball under pressure, who can set the tempo a little bit in midfield. You know, I think he adds something that you don't really get from any of the other crop. And
is he pivotal or double pivotal?
Hey, maybe both. Just to back up what Paul McGinnis said, I did had a very quick check of the stats, and you are right. Henderson hardly misplaced the pass either against Kosovo or against Bulgaria. Yeah, so it might be the change of shape in midfield has flummoxed him a little bit.
And just a lot bigger distances to cover with the passes.
We should mention the Czechs. They played well, didn't they? Especially the 30-year-old debutant who scored the winner last.
Yeah, Zdeněk Ondrášek, who has played in Norway for 4 years up at Tromsø, really far up north. Very popular guy up there because it's one of those, it's not a lot to do, you know, the weather's a bit bad a lot of the time. So if you come there as a foreigner with no connection to the place at all, it's kind of easy for your head to drop and sort of think, what's my career gone to? What am I doing here? But he worked really hard and became a big favourite up there. He's since moved on. He's currently at FC Dallas. On the bench for most of the year for FC Dallas, only recently started breaking into the team, and he's got his international debut and scored against England. Really, and you can see his teammates were really happy for him. You know, he's a hardworking guy. He's unlikely to be a superstar in any version of reality, but you know, he's good. That's it.
I mean, he's the sort of person who I think I would, even if I wasn't happy for him, I would pretend to look happy for him because he's got quite a scary face.
I mean, it's been mentioned a few places, but nicknamed the Cobra because he's got a massive tattoo of a cobra on his back.
Oh, marvellous. So, look, away to Bulgaria tonight. If England win and Kosovo fail to beat Montenegro, England qualify for the Euros and it will come home. we'll be doing daily pods almost certainly to watch my existential crisis as we get knocked out in the semi-finals, probably by Croatia again, who last night drew with Wales in Wales. 2 points for Wales in this international break. Both 1-1 draws. That one against Croatia. Before that, 1-1 in Slovakia. Kiefer Moore, who we discussed on Thursday, a great moment for him scoring against Slovakia. And he was brilliant last night as well, I thought, Lars. Classic old school target man. We've been led to believe a man of this ilk. You know, it was a dying art.
Have you?
Yeah, the target man is a dying art because people play one up top and they can't do both jobs because they're not quick enough. But he could... He really held his own against Lovren and Vida, didn't he?
Yes, but though I would argue that in the age of the sort of inwards goal-scoring winger, the target man should be in more demand than ever, you know, someone to bounce it off of. The Giroux of this world. Yeah. Maybe Kiefer Moore can be like a less flashy Giroux. But this is a good point, though, for Wales, surely. The last point was maybe not so good a point, but this is a decent point.
But they needed to win.
They need to win the remaining two games and hope that Slovakia drop points, which is entirely possible because I think Slovakia have to play Croatia away. It was a decent point. I think Wales will be happy enough with that, but they will probably rue not beating Slovakia, who they had on the ropes and just failed to convert chances.
The Croats were very physical, Lars. Maybe I was just being one-eyed because I wanted Wales to win, but I thought they took tactical fouling to a sort of new level. I mean, Pep would be proud because they weren't just like nipping at people's heels. They were just sort of generally flying into the Welsh players one by one.
I do like that, actually. If you're going to do a tactical foul, might as well clean the person out. Like, not dangerously so, but instead of doing the slight tug of the shirt, just do a tackle. There's a video doing the rounds about Stefan Johansson at Fulham. Who there are so many amazing tackles when he's clearly just taking one for the team and stopping an attack and accepting a card, where instead of just having a weak kick or pulling at it, he's just cleaned out the player. It's magnificent stuff. They're Croatia. They have that in them. They're a combative bunch. I don't know what you were expecting.
I was just wondering if there was a... It seemed like, you know, each individual challenge is probably a yellow. I thought Petrovic, when he went into Ampadu, could have been a red, actually, because he really slammed him. Vida went into Daniel James as well. You just sort of think, at some point, with tactical fouling generally, not just Croatia, is there a sanction? Is there a way you could say, come on, like, you've committed 30 fouls now. You have to just take sin bin one of your players for 10 minutes.
In rugby, if a team is continuously fouling the ref will take the captain to one side and go, next one's a yellow card. Doesn't matter who it is. Mm. But you could possibly have a similar thing in football, but it would presumably present a dizzying array of problems that I haven't really thought about.
I wonder to what extent knowing who the referee is makes an influence on how you know extensive you employ this tactic in a game. If you think, well, this is a guy who's reluctant to give the yellows, therefore we go for it. But if the first two rotational fouls get yellow cards, then you're probably not going to be able to pursue that tactic for the whole of the match.
I mean, Croatian fans would say that Ben Davis possibly fouled his man in the build-up to Bale's goal. But even still, it's just an interesting thought for FIFA, you know, if they want to clamp down on tactical fouling. Barry, would you like to get on your high horse about Daniel James or not? He got clattered by Vida. He went down. Apparently, he was okay, but he went down in a heap to perhaps... Well, Ryan Giggs said in the press conference, not trying to get the man sent off, but using a bit of kidology, which I translated as trying to get the man sent off.
Well, I'll take Ryan Giggs' word for it, but he did look a little groggy afterwards. I thought he was out cold, and the ref should have adhered to UEFA guidelines, presumably by, you know, you get 3 minutes to, you know, hold up fingers and ask who the Prime Minister is and whatnot. Which could be a difficult question in the current political climate for a young footballer to answer, or anyone else indeed. But I will sit on my high horse and, you know, not so much bang my drum, but, you know, what's that little spatula brush thing you...
Oh, like the snare. Not a snare drum. No, I don't know. I know what you mean.
Sort of caress it with that.
Yeah. It's for your swing. When you're doing a swing time beat, when we're at the O2. Yeah, that one. I mean, I think Daniel James would know who the Prime Minister was.
Oh, no, I would say yes, he would. I didn't mean to disparage footballers in general. Just in the current climate, it could be you ask someone who the Prime Minister is, there's a very good chance they might get it wrong.
Lars, you look like you're about to make a very salient point.
Well, not really, but we've got a tweet from Jordan Smith saying, "Where has Kiefer Moore been all my life? Is it warranted to now consider him the best ever Kiefer?"
I mean, there's only one real...
probably. He's been...
German artist Anselm Kiefer, who's not bad, actually. Quite right.
But his footballing CV would suggest that he's not just been one place all of Jordan's life. I mean, he's been a number of places, such as Truro City, Dorchester Town, Yeovil, and Viking in my country, where he played 9 games and scored no goals. And he's also been to Ipswich.
Surely on how old Jordan is.
That's true. He might be very young.
Jordan is only 6 months old.
He's also been at Forest Green, Ipswich, Rotherham, Barnsley, and he's now at Wigan.
So, Wales need to win both of their final two group games. Hope that Slovakia slip up. And that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with the Republic of Ireland's fascinating goalless draw in Georgia. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's run you through our live shows. October the 30th, Science Museum. Don't know why I'm telling you about it, because it's sold out. Football Ooh. Weekly versus Science. November the 27th, Indigo at the O2. Not sold out yet, because quite a big venue. Me, Glenn Denning, Wilson and Ellis James, plus special guests. I mean, I'm just saying, that's not confirmed.
Okay.
But, you know, hopefully a cameo from Lars with his euphonium. I don't know. You interested, Lars? Go on.
Sure. Okay, I've done worse.
Really a surprise now, is it? But anyway, some fun. Anyway, just come to the O2.
It would be fun to play the O2 with the euphonium.
There you go, wouldn't it? I like the idea of it just starting like a band. There we are. You know, like the spotlights go bang. Barry's on drums on his high horse. Ellis is on lead guitar. Wilson's on bass. I'm on the clarinet. And then Lars, boom, euphonium.
The last band I saw at the O2, I think, was AC/DC.
Okay,
so
we can do that.
Lars and his euphonium is quite a departure.
On the 20th of December, me, Lars, Wilson and one more playing the Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. And the 27th of January, almost sold out, Dublin, Liberty Hall, me, Baz, plus a couple of others. If we do sell out, we'll do another night. Right, Speaking of Ireland, a brilliant idea from Jack here after the Georgia Republic goalless draw. Should there be a separate league for hoofball specialists after Ireland, Georgia? I would pay money to watch just a teams. It's probably League Two, isn't it? Let's face it. But you know, just teams of internationals just whacking it long. Barry, how was this football match?
It was excruciating, as many Republic of Ireland matches tend to be. Republic of Ireland are top of their group, and I'm mystified as to how that can be.
They've played two games against Gibraltar.
Yeah, but I mean, they're just one win away from qualification with games against Denmark and the Swiss to come. You know, we're in that circle of hell where just, particularly for Denmark, I would say, where we just play them over and over and over and over and over again. Tomorrow we play the Swiss, and if we beat them, we've qualified. And it's quite remarkable because we don't score many goals. We're not very good. And yet we're top of the group. The game against Georgia, Mick McCarthy saw it as a good result. I think not all the Irish media are in entire agreement with him. The performance was poor. He didn't pick Aaron Connolly, who's now our, you know, great young hope for the future following his brace for Brighton against Tottenham Hotspur. He only got 12 minutes in that game and made a big impression in those 12 minutes. He had two chances, brought a save out of the Georgian keeper, and then was put through by a rather agricultural clump up the field from
Liam Daish.
No, it was Glenn Whelan. Well. Yeah, even looking at the starting lineup, I saw the Ireland posing for the photo, and I thought Glenn Whelan had retired, like completely retired, not just from international football, but there he was, and he almost provided an assist. He leathered the ball upfield. Aaron Connolly got in the end of it, got in behind the Georgian defence, and then fired into the side netting when perhaps he should have done a little better.
I liked Mick McCarthy. He was asked if he regretted not bringing Connolly on, and he replied, "Not really, no. I was conscious of making sure we could defend free kicks and corners as much as anything with the bodies we have in the box," which doesn't necessarily imply that he was really looking to win as opposed to just take the point. But I suppose it's not a bad point if they're in the position they're in, right?
Well, as I say, they've two games left to go and they need to win one of them to go through. But their record against Switzerland and Denmark, who they seem to end up in playing an awful lot, isn't particularly good. I don't think they've beaten them in a very long time. But I reckon we'll probably get through. I wouldn't expect us to pull up too many trees. I mean, I said earlier that I don't think England are as good as a lot of England fans think they are. I think Ireland are even worse than I think they are, and I think they're pretty bad.
I think if you played you have six goals in six games, and two of those six games were against Gibraltar, that's not an ideal situation.
I'm starting to think, you know, the sort of existential crisis that Denmark are in for playing Ireland all the time. It's put me in an existential crisis of hearing you talk about the existential crisis. I just think the sentence I've heard most from you in my entire life is how depressed the Danes are to play the Irish.
But it's they are. I mean, after their last game, Christian Eriksen, you know, I think having to play Ireland so often might be affecting his form with Tottenham. He knows it's in the pipe, and he's just sad.
Now, they're away to Switzerland on Tuesday. Denmark beat Switzerland 1-0, and the late goal. And Kasper Schmeichel made four pretty brilliant saves in this game.
Yeah,
didn't he?
Some great saves. And we talk about Eriksen obviously not having a good time at Tottenham at the moment. Doesn't want to be there. Doesn't look energetic and fired up and all that. Amazing assist for Denmark's goal. That was just a glimpse of what he can do. That reverse pass into Josip Poulsen was quite something.
And our Northern Ireland went to the Netherlands, and for 80 minutes, I mean, they were so good. Josh McGuinness put them ahead 16 minutes from the end. You could just see what it meant to those Northern Ireland fans. And you thought, this 16 minutes is going to feel like an absolute lifetime. And then Memphis Depay great touch and finish for the first goal. And then they got so lucky with Luke de Jong. Someone tweeted, I'd forgotten, he said, nobody should be allowed to score a goal when they're holding onto the post, which I thought... That's a very good point.
Well, I think people looked around to see he's so far. It must be offside somehow. You know, the player defenders from there. He wasn't. No, he did almost manage to. Yeah, like it is a very odd goal.
It's weird, isn't it?
I think it would have dropped in anyway. But it was odd. He sort of sliced it straight into the air initially.
I suppose, you know, if we're going to look at the stats, Lars, which is something that you mm-hmm. like to do, then Netherlands probably deserved this, right?
Yeah, for sure. But I do think that the first goal from Memphis there was key because they were really struggling to find the breakthrough. And Memphis can be an infuriating player, and it was a very Memphis performance because he took, I think, three shots from way outside the box in positions where he shouldn't have shot at all. And he will drive you slightly bonkers as a player, but I think it's interesting that he's being played up front both for Lyon now and for Netherlands, because I think managers are seeing that he does have something about him. He can unlock a game, he can make things happen. You just have to take the rough with the smooth and accept that he will sort of lamp it into the stands occasionally as well.
In that group yesterday, Netherlands won 2-1 in Belarus, 2 for Gigi Wijnaldum. I always call him Gigi. It's really hard, isn't it? Once you said G once, you want to say it again. 2 for Gigi Wijnaldum, including one absolute banger. The road to automatic qualification is tough for Northern Ireland. Realistically, they need to beat both the Netherlands and Germany next month, and or hope that one of them slips up against one of the lesser teams.
But it's quite incredible for them to be only 3 points behind the two at the pair. Yeah.
That is very much because they didn't have to play them at all until... this game. Oh no, they played Germany, did they?
But I think they have done really well, and I mean, they if they had held on to that result, I mean, they would have. Yeah, mm. So that's very tough on them.
Well, you know, as we've mentioned a million times, Michael O'Neill still pulling up trees compared to whoever happens to be the Scotland manager at the time. It's currently Steve Clark. They lost 4-0 in Russia, including Magomed Ozdoev went full Vasily Rat, didn't he, Lars, with one of these. Absolute, just struck it beautifully from 30 yards. It was a total joy. Then Scotland played San Marino and won 6-0. John McGinn got a hat-trick. First goal for Scotland for Dundee United's Lawrence Shankland. First goal for Scotland for Stuart Finlay on his debut. The first Kilmarnock goalscorer for Scotland since Tommy McLean against Wales in Wrexham in 1969. That fact courtesy of Stuart McGowan. Craig Armstrong scored a lovely free kick. Richard Jolly, he of the great stats. John McGinn has scored more goals than Newcastle this season and as many as Malaga. But this game was most fun for quite how wet it was in the second half. Ball, you know, just so much standing water. There was just...
I love watching games like played in those conditions. Yeah. Even though they are quite dangerous for the players. But yeah, I was thinking, God, if this gets abandoned, that would just sum up Scotland's luck in a nutshell.
I mean, it could have been, couldn't it? I really thought...
I thought it would be. I was surprised it wasn't. But, yeah, I don't think the importance of this win, even though it was against San Marino, only against San Marino, can be overstated. Scotland just desperately needed to win a game of football and score some goals. They did both and won't care in the slightest about the inclement damp conditions.
I'm not sure. I think, you know, they're the worst team in the world, and
San Marino would be clear, not Scotland.
Yeah,
well, Scotland are getting there.
I think, you know, they seem to, you know, they're on course for playoffs and through because of their Nations League performance, and Bulgaria could be one of their opponents.
Yeah, they play either Israel or Bulgaria, with the winner of Norway Serbia waiting in the final.
Yeah. I mean, I struggle to see them getting through the semi-finals, never mind the finals of that. The one good thing is that, you know, he is bringing through new players and he's changing the squad, and there at least looks like a number of people who would want to play for the shirt rather than sort of feel the weight of the shirt when they're brought in from the Premier League to try and drag him over the line. And, you know, John McGinn, can't say enough about him. He's a great player.
It's just, okay, so this is the debate that kind of comes around every couple of years, and we're nothing if not cosmopolitan on this pod. But like San Marino, what's the point? Like, there are 33,000 people there or something, and they never do anything. Like, we've seen with Iceland, for example, like, it is possible for a small country to do great things. But with these professionals who have to play 40, 50 games a year, I can see why they feel a bit hacked off that they have to spend time playing against San Marino, because it's just they're not going to get any better.
Well, they might do. I mean, because like you say, because they could be like Iceland, they could introduce a, you know, a grassroots up system of developing their footballers. And I'm pro crap qualification, because I do think in the long term it drags up standards. But you are going to have exceptions. You are going to have some malingerers in and amongst them. If you look at Gibraltar, compare them to Gibraltar, who are making a real go of it. So, you know, you can't, it'd be a bit arbitrary to start saying, no, we're going to exclude you from national comp. You could do that, maybe. You could relegate people from all competition if you're that bad. And
how did they do in the Nations League? Were they similarly bad in the Nations League? Because isn't the point of the Nations League was you had Division D and it was good fun.
They were in Group D and I think they lost all their games and scored no goals. So, you know. But I'm sorry, it's just...
Do you think they enjoy it?
Because I'm like, whenever I hear this debate on the radio, my instinctive reaction is to defend the small teams against like the arrogant people who don't want them to have a say, right? I'm completely contradicting my own instincts here. I've had a moment where I've just realized they were the only team in Group D, in League D, that got no points and scored no goals. At some point, like, when do you just say there's not, just as a country, they exist because at some point in history, when Italy used to be all hilly city states, right? And then they all got unified, and for some reason, San Marino wasn't.
San Marino.
Yeah, San Marino just wasn't made part of Italy. And because of that, they have this national team. We're going to get like inundated with angry emails from San Marino now.
I imagine we have one listener in San Marino, and I would like them to come up with a stout defence for your nation, which is being torn apart by Lars Sivertsen.
Because as a person, I would like my instinct is that everyone should have a go in this sort of thing. Mm. But I've run out of arguments for why this should be a thing.
Okay.
So please educate me, San Marino.
Footballing dinosaur Lars Sivertsen. Yeah. He's off out drinking with Big Sam and Alan Brazil after the pod.
But no, honestly, I'd love to be convinced I'm wrong on this, so hit me up on Twitter or whatever.
Politics Alistair Campbell says, if you're wondering why none of the San Marino players were singing the national anthem, it's because it's one of four national anthems with no lyrics. Would you like to know the other ones?
Italy's?
Nope.
Oh, I kind of feel like I know.
Why is that so funny?
It's like every single World Cup we have like, oh, look at them, they're singing so full-throatedly and stuff with Italy.
Yeah.
Tend to tune out.
Maybe they're just... Yeah.
Spain, Kosovo and Bosnia-Herzegovina.
All right.
There we are. Also in that group, Belgium won 2-0 in Kazakhstan after putting 9 past San Marino on Thursday. They've qualified. Michy Batshuayi was wearing SpongeBob SquarePants pants during that game.
So I was looking this up, this small nation thing. I found a list. Someone had taken the FIFA ranking per capita and made a list.
Okay.
Now, it's slightly outdated. It is from 2017, but I think it's still interesting. Who do you think are top?
Iceland or Finland.
So people would think that, but it's not Iceland. I would have
Belgium?
Thought that. No, it's not. It's not Iceland. It's not even close. It's another country.
Oh, I'm enjoying this quiz. What am I dividing by? Population?
Yeah.
Northern Ireland?
Points in the FIFA ranking.
Uruguay.
Northern Ireland are pretty high, but it's not Northern Ireland.
Uruguay.
Nope. They're not very good.
Oh.
But they're not completely atrocious.
Ah.
Panama.
Maybe they are completely atrocious, but no.
Okay.
I'm going to end this now. It's the Faroe Islands.
Oh, okay.
There are like 50,000 of them, and at least in 2017, they were 86th on the ranking with some points.
And where is San Marino?
They're pretty far down even on this ranking, because they're awful.
Okay, well, thanks for the
Do you know who's the worst? Well, that's going to be obvious.
China?
Yes, very, by a mile. But who's the second worst? This is kind of fun.
Is it fun? I mean, it's...
I think so.
You have taken over the pod once again, the Lars Sivertsen show, for your own quiz, and then decided it's fun.
I have to say, I'm not enjoying this quiz.
Okay, we'll leave it there.
You mentioned China, and I was going to do this in part three, but since you brought it up, Barney wrote a piece about China's plans to win a major tournament, given that they're, you know, currently per capita they're worse than San Marino. Writing a piece about former Everton England under-21 defender Tyus Browning, who's now a Chinese citizen, has a Chinese name, Zhang Guangtai. He signed for Guangzhou Evergrande in February after playing for Sunderland, Preston and Wigan. 6 months later, he's officially Chinese. He doesn't qualify yet to play for them, but will do. 5 years ago, he was on the bench next to Harry Kane as Gareth Southgate, England under 21 team, played Wales in a qualifier. There's also Nico Yanaris, played for China against Guam this week. He used to play for Arsenal and all the England age groups, became the first naturalised player for the Chinese team. He has a Chinese name, Li Qi. They both have Chinese links. You know, it's a bit like Kiefer Moore playing for Wales or, you know, the Ireland squad under Jack Charlton. He talks about the naturalisations of these Brazilian journeymen. Ikerson, a 30-year-old Brazilian from Maranhão, played for China in this 7-0 win over Guam. Someone called Ricardo Goulart. Alex Teixeira may well be naturalised by the 2022 World Cup.
Ricardo Goulart, I think, does he play for Beijing? Anyway, he's been there for quite a few seasons in the CSL, and I think he's put, you know, he's done the hard yards.
Sure, but I suppose the question is, what is the point of international sport? Is Barney writes, this is not a test of genes. It's not supposed to be about soft power or reflecting glory or political egomaniacs. The only logical purpose is a test of systems, a way of seeing how well, how efficiently each country has arranged its resources, of learning from one another for the wider public good, working out what works, what doesn't work.
I don't understand that. What does that mean?
I don't know. I just thought it sounded clever. That's what I do when I read Barney's thing. No. I mean, I suppose he means he's questioning what is the point of all of this? You know, we do all these qualifiers. We take players that aren't necessarily, you know, you look at Peterson playing cricket for England and we go, oh, it's fine. They're good. It's fine. And we all do it. It does make you question what is the point.
I think it is a valid question. The Irish rugby team have a few ringers in who aren't Irish, you know, and don't have any connection to Ireland apart from the fact that they've lived there for 3 years and gotten the Irish team because they weren't good enough to get on the Australian team or the South African team or whatever. I personally don't think it should be allowed because there are perfectly serviceable Irish players who could take their places in the team and those Irish guys aren't getting an opportunity. Does that make me sound like an old Brexity kind of...
I don't know.
Anti-foreign.
My instinct is it's my view. Yeah, my instinct is it does make you sound like that. But then there isn't any. Then it's just club football in another name. Then otherwise.
Well, I guess it's one of these things that's hard to write rules that make sense because I do think it should be possible if you're born in one country but you move somewhere else and you stay there for a long time and you put down roots and you know socially and culturally you feel like you fit in there, like that's your future, that's your home now. I don't think you should be necessarily barred from representing them at a sport if you're really good at it. It makes sense that there should be an opening for that. But at the same time, it's clearly wrong if we had international football. You have a bunch of countries that turn up with the random naturalized Brazilians. Like, that's not what you're looking for either. Yeah. So it's hard to write a rule that still allows for the sort of modern, sort of cosmopolitan freedom of movement sort of type of world we have.
Yeah, you can set the bar a bit higher, can't you? At 6 or 7 years... I'm not sure I know the rules in terms of football, but I suspect it's probably more than three. But you know, you can set the bar a bit high. You can adjust those criteria, and I agree with Lars. I think we do live in a world where people emigrate, and that, you know, people can become citizens of a country that are just as much a citizen of a country as somebody who was born there. And these people should be included. But I kind of feel like with the cricket stuff, it's a bit like, yeah, there's a sort of easy way to sort of filter into the England cricket team, which was to play in Australia or South Africa.
It's sort of a what comes first thing. You know, if you happen to be a Tongan, like, brilliant rugby player, but you moved to Tipperary, you know, and then you built your life there, that's slightly different to someone scouting around and going, do you want to come here for a bit?
Yeah, you know? and also moving to Tipperary with one eye on becoming a professional rugby player at the end of it, you know, and having a better chance of being successful in that career. So there is lots of grey.
Sure, and Barney says, and I agree, you can't really knock the player because, you know, your football career is a sort of journey that you don't know where it's going to end up. And at some point you say, oh, I want a piece of that. That looks fun. And if I'm not good enough to play for X, I might be good enough to play for Y. You know, you want to play in a World Cup and... Why not, right?
I don't feel particularly strongly about it.
No.
I don't. But say, for the sake of argument, China suddenly came and swept all before them at the next World Cup with, you know, nobody Chinese in their team, there will be uproar.
Yeah, in China. you know, I mean, there wouldn't be uproar because people wouldn't risk it. But, you know, there would be dissatisfaction amongst the domestic audience and not seeing people that they identified with. So there is a counterbalancing effect that you can only go so far with these measures. You know, you might raise your competitive standing, but you might also lose the affection of the public in the process. So,
But I don't think that's
you
true.
You may well be right, Paul, but say at the Rugby World Cup, Japan have made a lot of friends and many of their squad that beat Scotland are not Japanese. Is that a problem? I don't know. The Japanese fans certainly don't mind.
No.
Can easily look at a team like Japan, which I think is 9 of the 15 were Japanese. Really okay. Known to that. You know, that this is, you can see these guys who come into the team as helping develop, you know, but bringing along the players. And that's one of the things in the Chinese Super League is that they've had a lot, you know, some quite strict regulations on the number of Chinese nationals who need to be in the teams. Mm-hmm. And that's actually held the development of the league back because the gulf is still quite big between the imports and the people who are already there. But, you know, I think that is taking into account the issue of, well, you've got to be able to bring the fans with you. If it was just perceived that you just bought the entire team and all the success, how many people would actually be bothered about that? I'm not sure.
I think there needs to be, like I said, a lot of grey zones. There needs to be a possibility for naturalisation. But like you have in other sports, you've had weirder situations. Like in the 2015 Handball World Championship, the Qatar squad featured, I think, 7 players who were born in a different country who had been naturalised, and they were from all over the gaff.
Yeah,
and I mean, it was just a bit odd.
I don't think one of the worst examples you can think of, because yeah. A, they've got a World Cup coming, they've got to have prestige, they've got no population. And they got loads of money.
Also in that group, if you can remember what group we were talking about, which is Scotland's group, Russia qualified after that 5-0 win at Cyprus following their 4-0 win over the Scots. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up the rest of the European qualifiers, the Football League and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Group J, everyone. 7 from 7 for Italy. 2-0 win over Greece. How good are Italy, Lars? I mean, I had written that question for Nikki Mandini. She's not here.
They're pretty decent. They have, what Mancini's done, he's brought through some younger players and made that a big focal point. And obviously being undefeated, well, they've won all their games. They've only conceded 3 in 7. They've scored 20. You know, they're looking good. If you look at their midfield, Jorginho at the base, Verratti kind of buzzing around, and Barella as well, offering mobility and a lot of different things. That's a really good midfield. Insigne finally being trusted to play a leading role in the national team is very good. And they've got Chiesa or Bernardeschi, depending on who starts on the other side. I mean, they're one, certainly a centre forward, maybe short of being very good. Immobile played here. He's never really done it internationally. Belotti is busy, runs around, but maybe not quite at the sort of standard you'd hope. So they lack a proper number 9 in the middle there. But there's a lot to like about the team, and they're very un-Italian in the sense that they're not the sort of attritional, solid, dependable. I mean, they can be quite flaky. They conceded 3 goals in qualifying, but looking at the squad, this is not a team you'd expect to go to a World Cup and just shut everyone out.
Should I grow up, or am I still allowed to find it amusing that there is an international centre forward with the surname Immobile?
Well, technically it's Immobile.
Yes, I understand. But I every time I see it, I'm very pleased because Immobile is such a great criticism for a centre forward, isn't it? You know, when you're called Immobile, it's just like someone has the final nail in the coffin for you.
But it is an ongoing blow to the concept of nominative determinism because he does get around the pitch. You know, he's not particularly immobile. So it's kind of like in reverse.
In Serie A news, while we're on Italy, Claudio Ranieri's got the Sampdoria job. Should I be surprised about this, Lars? It's nice to see him just popping up again.
Well, most of all, it's funny that like Marco Giampaolo leaving Sampdoria to go to Milan has not worked out well for anyone. He's already been sacked from Milan, and Sampdoria are bottom of the league, so that was a complete failure for everyone involved. I think, yeah, bringing in someone like him who's back to basics, you know, experienced hands, I mean, that might make sense for Samp, who are struggling a bit.
Group F, still with you, Lars. Norway didn't lose to Spain. They would. Josh King with a late penalty, the first points that Spain have dropped in the group.
And not undeserved either. We were decent in this game, and I have to eat a number of hats because I was very certain we'd get tonked, and we weren't. And Lars Lagerbäck is doing a very good job there. I've made fun of them for, in the last away to Sweden here, He's basically lined up with four central midfielders, with Fulham, Stefan Johansson playing right wing, and Ola Selnes, also very much a central midfielder, playing left wing. But what it does make you is it makes you quite solid, and they were very diligent in pressing. The players themselves has referred to Lagerbäck's coaching as something akin to brainwashing, because they have a lot of meetings where they talk about what they're going to do, like tactically. I guess Roy Hodgson has a good point of comparison. You know, he sets them up in two banks of four. Everyone knows their job. Everyone knows where they're meant to stand, where they're meant to be. But we've become solid again. We've become harder to beat, and we have now attacking players and Martin Ødegaard, who's blossoming and blooming and becoming the player we all hoped he would be, and Josh King, who's maturing into a very decent centre forward.
Where does Ødegaard play in that formation? Is he one?
Well, yeah, no, he's the number 10. So you have four central midfielders and then Ødegaard in front of it,
and he's allowed to a bit more license.
Yes, and I guess the big question is Erling Braut Haaland missed this with a hip injury when he comes in, because he has all the makings of someone who's going to play up front for Norway for the next 10 years. So how you fit in him and King and Ødegaard with the preferred two banks of four, I'm not quite sure how you make that work. But at least Norway have some kind of solidity now. They don't roll over. And that's very positive after we've been terrible for a very long time.
Barry, would you like to pay tribute to Sergio Ramos, 168th cap, Europe's most capped outfield player?
Yeah, hats. Many of Lars's hats before he eats them off to Sergio Ramos. I admire him. I'm slightly envious of him. He's a smolderingly handsome man. He's a very successful man. He's, according to Sid, despite what you might conclude from watching him play, a very, very nice man. He's had a fantastic career and... Good luck to him.
It turns out that shit housing keeps you young.
Yeah. See, is that why I look so old?
Yeah, exactly, because you're too likeable.
It's the problem.
If you were going around digging your elbow into people's ribs on the way in and out of tube carriages, you'd probably be...
Before we move on, can I just flag up our right-backing captain, Omar El Abdullahi, who basically got us the goal, because the equaliser was a penalty in extra time, and it was Kepa came sort of ill-advised, came flying out with a big fist, and our galloping right-back captain, Omar El Abdullahi, saw that fist and thought, I'll put my head straight in there. And the fist just about missed his head, but he nearly had his head locked off there. There was a tremendous act of bravery from Omar there.
He was at Southampton, was he?
That's Moy Elunusi, I think you might be thinking of. Or Omar Abdullahi was at Hull briefly. Without that working out very well. He's been playing very well for Olympiakos. I think he could do well at a bigger club, maybe.
Three games in that group on Tuesday. Spain are virtually there. Then one of Romania or Sweden. Can you do the Nations League? You can.
Yes. Looks like we'll end up meeting Serbia there. This point was good. It was a good point for us, and it was a good sort of confidence building performance. It doesn't do that much for us in terms of qualifying. We're still in trouble. We need Sweden and Romania to draw when they play each other. And we need to beat Romania ourselves. And there's a lot of permutations afoot. But what I would say for us, since I get to talk about this now, there's a sort of sense that the team is coming together, that you're building a bit of confidence going into these playoffs. So against Serbia, I think that'll be an interesting matchup.
Now, we were talking about tactical fouling, and Rodri was of players who were speaking to their own journalists and forgetting that people can translate, etc.
You said, but this is kind of... in the grey zone, because I think he was talking to Sid Lowe.
Oh, was he?
But then again, that is kind of speaking to...
Yeah. He may not have... Well, he didn't necessarily think it through, but what did he say?
Well, he did say that. I mean, it's a really interesting interview, and he comes across as a really thoughtful guy, so it's slightly unfair taking this one little bit and taking it out of it. And I do advise you to look up Sid Lowe's interview with Rodri. It's really interesting. But he does say that one of the things he's had to learn since coming to City is when to do tactical fouls, which for Pep Guardiola is a little bit awkward, since he insists that's something they don't do.
Group H, big game tonight, sees France play Turkey. Both have 18 points from 7 games. Winner qualifies. France beat Iceland 1-0, courtesy of a dodgy penalty. Antoine Griezmann was touched and then went down about 2.5 minutes later as if he'd been shot by a sniper.
Yeah, although I think if you look at the replays, he does get a whack. Okay. So it's fair enough. It's just the delay that makes it look a bit odd. But I wonder if players just feel like they have to do this, like, because if you stay on your feet, you never get the penalty, even if you have been fouled. Mm-hmm. So it is just, I think the referees need to just, yeah,
Okay, Iceland can still qualify if France win, and they beat Turkey next month. They're guaranteed a playoff place if it doesn't go their way. Lars?
UEFA are looking into whether Turkey's celebration against Albania, they celebrated by doing military salutes, which could be considered a political gesture. It's certainly in very poor taste at the moment, I think most people would think, and that's something UEFA are looking into.
All right. In the Football League, in League One, the top two, Ipswich and Wickham, didn't play. Peterborough have closed the gap in third with a 2-0 win over Lincoln. Bristol Rovers up to fourth with a 1-0 win over MK Dons. After no wins in 11, now 2-2 for AFC Wimbledon, who won 4-1 at Southend. In League Two, Crewe are top. They won 4-2 at Carlisle. Exeter in second are on the same points after a 1-0 at home to Forest Green. Morecambe are bottom because they lost and Stevenage won. And Cambridge were robbed 1-0. At Salford in the WSL. Big game of the weekend saw Chelsea beat champions Arsenal 2-1. Daniel van der Donk put Arsenal ahead. Chelsea hit back with two second half goals. Good finishes from Beth England and Maria Torres-Dottir. Is that how I pronounce it?
Torres-Dottir. She's the daughter of the Norwegian national handball team coach, actually. She's very good.
I believe that's filled our quota of references to handball in this podcast. That was Arsenal's first defeat in the league since January. Sees Chelsea move above them into second. Man City are top and the last team in the WSL with a 100% record. They beat bottom side Birmingham 3-0. Birmingham now alone at the bottom as Liverpool picked up their first point of the season with a 1-1 draw against Bristol City, and Manchester United picked up their second win on the bounce. They beat Spurs 3-0. Any other business? James has a question. How is Lars's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer table looking these days?
Well, I should say, it was never my table. I'm too lazy to actually like put in the work and make a table like that. It was someone else for making the table, and I think it has been closed as far as I'm aware. Maybe it's time to make a new Solskjaer table.
So the table was only there when Man United were doing well, and then the Norwegians have stopped talking about it.
Pretty much. I wouldn't say that we've stopped talking about it. People are very much still talking about it, but in slightly different terms. No, I think the Solskjaer table has not been updated for a good while.
I just stayed.
So they're still third in the Solskjaer table. But yeah, it's been a while since it was updated.
Congratulations to Petr Cech, playing in his first ever ice hockey match for Guildford Phoenix, and he saved the critical penalty, which is like a one-on-one, you know, you slide forward and then you whip it along with your stick. And I mean, it proved once again that the trouble with ice hockey is you can't see the bloody thing. But even still, he saved it. And there was a bit of footage of him before the game, just saving absolutely anything. It was like a cartoon with sort of Inspector Gadget hands. So well done, Petr Cech. Thank you to Arne, who has sent me this tweet from a man called Simon, who says the definition of woe in the Google Dictionary actually has Everton in it. Noun, literally, great sorrow or distress, brackets often used hyperbolically. The Everton tale of woe continues.
I was watching Sky Sports News yesterday and Duncan Ferguson appeared.
Oh, I saw your tweet, yeah.
And it occurred to me, he was interviewed and I've never, ever heard him speak before. Because he wouldn't speak to journalists as a player because the guy had the hump over media coverage of the incident when he was a Rangers player that led to him being sent to the big house.
What am I hoping for? I'm hoping for a Rab C. Nesbitt, but what am I getting?
He's pretty much what you'd expect.
Okay. It is like when you hear a referee talk for the first time. Extraordinary, isn't it? The first time you heard Mark Clattenburg, you think, I've never presumed he'd be that Geordie.
Aye, aye, man.
Kieran says it's the second annual Canadian Thanksgiving reminder. What are you thankful for? What are you thankful for, Paul?
I have to say, I'm thankful for the long-term vision of Stuart Webber and Daniel Fark that will see us through the vicissitudes of the season.
Okay, excellent. Barry, did you remember to wish your sister a happy Thanksgiving?
No.
Will you do it after the pod?
Possibly, yes.
Okay, good. Paul, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
See you Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.